Where are you staying?
I've got me at the Hotel Wales, which is up there, 93rd and Madison. Out of Reading at 93rd and Madison, so they're trying to stick me in the same neighborhood.
What store? I didn't know that.
There's a corner books. It's called the Corner Bookstore, 93rd Madison. Uh-huh. Wonderful people who run it. Just great. Mm-hmm. A very small hole-in-the-wall place, but everything in there is choice.
Yeah, there are a number of bookstores like that. There's Books and Company on Madison, also on Madison Avenue. Have you been there?
How far up is that?
It's just below the Whitney, so it's about 74th.
I think I have stopped in there once. Is that Perry Haberman's store?
I'm not sure who the proprietor is. Yeah. Have you, do you like used books?
Half the books I own are used books. I love used books, and I got hooked in England. Have you spent any time in England?
I have been there as a tourist.
There's a place called Hay on Wye. It is the used book capital of the Western world. Every store has been turned over into books. In fact, there are places where you buy books by the pound. You just pull them off the carts and they weigh them, and you pay by the pound, and you can find anything. Of course, you find an awful lot of James Russell Lowell who's made his way over there. He seems to be the bane of bookstores. But just an amazing, amazing collection. And I got hooked then, and at the Strand, of course.
Oh, I go to the Strand. I think I'm there about every week.
God, I can't go in there with a credit card if I want to remain financially intact.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, I had a whole bunch of books. I just had to clear my apartment out a little bit. So I packed up two shopping bags of books and decided to take them down to the Strand and sell them, which I did. I got $75 for the two shopping bags of books. Not bad. But I wound up buying $35 worth of books and taking them back home again. And I can't believe it. I said, Swaim, why are you doing this? You know, you sold $75 worth of books. You just bought another $35 to take back. You know, and I just couldn't help it.
Do you have the room for it?
I mean, no.
That's my next project is to buy some property, and it's not because I feel the need to have land or something. It's not some deep southern rooted thing. I got to put my books somewhere. I've got tons and tons.
Where do you live?
I'm between places, between apartments in New Orleans now. I was changing apartments, and I thought, well, I better. I was going to. I don't know how to explain it. I just didn't want to pay rent for 4 months while I was on the road. So, when I go back, I'll find a new place.
Well, where have you stored your stuff?
It's stored in one of those instant storage places in near a mall. Mm-hmm. So I'm hoping there's no hurricanes between now and then. And I've got stuff stored in Laguna Beach. I got a friend there. Stuff stored in Louisville. Stuff stored in Michigan. Stuff stored in my mother's basement and attic in North Carolina. She's issued a moratorium. There's no more books can come into the house at North Carolina.
I had a storage room in Upper Manhattan for my books, but after my divorce, I decided I didn't really want to pay $78 a month for the storage space. Mm. So I closed it out and moved all my books down to my new apartment, which is also on 92nd Street, by the way, on the west side. And I had carpenters come in to put floor-to-ceiling bookshelves, but I made them so that you could put the books two in a row.
Could
put them. Not the best way of displaying them.
No,
but I mean, a Manhattan apartment, and I'm sure it's the same if you live right in New Orleans. It's you know, apartment living is not conducive to book collecting.
It's not. That's why I've got to get some property, buy a house. I feel even if you don't look at a book, 5 years go by and you don't look at a book, the idea that it's up on the shelf, you gain something from it. I mean, there's a Winston Churchill quote somewhere about he felt not compelled to read every book in his library. He said it's enough to every once in a while pull one down, flip through the pages, get something from it, and put it back. And this is the advantage of a great library. And you can't have that advantage when they're all in boxes in my mother's basement.
Oh, that's why I hated the storage room. I needed some time ago. I needed a copy of Edgar Allan Poe. I was doing a series on Edgar Allan Poe for my book feature. And I wanted to have some of Poe's poems recorded. Now, I have a complete Poe up in the storage room, or I had at that time. But I also had a car then. I also got rid of the car. It simplified my life a lot. To get to the storage room, you had to have a car, right? I just didn't want to have to go get the car, drive up to the storage room, try to figure out which of the 40, 50 boxes that the Poe was in, So I went out to the bookstore and I bought a new Poe.
You got another one now. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's ridiculous. So I figured the storage room idea, it does store your books, but you don't have access to them. And what's the point? You know, if you love books, as you obviously do and as I do, how can you separate yourself from them? And what use are they in a storage locker?
Oh, yeah. For this book, for Gospel, I did a lot of research. I don't know if you've thumbed through it, but there's lots of footnotes and lots of sources. I bought 412 books. I counted it up for tax purposes, and I itemized it. But 412 books is more books than most people have, unfortunately. They're all theology. I'll probably never use some of them again. But some of the names, some of the exotics, or the Ethiopian church and these things, I want them. I want them on my shelf. I want them where I can reach for them at any time. And they're in boxes two at the moment.
Why, I can see the research you did. The disciple, the footnotes to the passages involving the disciple, you know, it shows in a tremendous amount of work. And I know that this didn't come just spontaneously. You had to put a lot of effort into that.
No, the footnotes are real. The threaded through the book is the gospel that the modern characters are hunting for. It's a first century gospel. And it's like you're reading a Penguin text. I've got the footnotes and the Greek explained and the Latin explained and allusions to everything. Some of the stuff in the footnotes, some of the background of the church is so unbelievable that we decided in the final draft we would put a note saying, yes, the footnotes are absolutely accurate. They're absolutely real. These quotes from other lost gospels and then this history out of Josephus, the first century historian, it's all true. It doesn't matter how unbelievable it is, it's true.
Well, I had to force myself not to read them. I mean, it became too time-consuming.
It is.
You're talking about an 800-page book.
Yeah.
And trying to read it and look at the footnotes was too disconcerting. If I had my leisure, I'm a casual reader, that would be something else. But I finally said, I've got to stop looking at these footnotes.
Well, it's just as well. People don't. It's the real heresy of the book, if there is any. I wouldn't say blasphemy, but there may be a bit of heresy in it. And the real heresy in the book is in the footnotes. That's where I discuss interpolation of words and attributed to Jesus that he could not have possibly said because of historical circumstances, or a dissection of the Greek of John or whatever that shows that this has got to be almost a century after Christ lived. There's no way this could be authentic. And so I think the real controversial stuff is hidden in the footnotes. So I'm not sure that I mind people skimming over them or skipping over them.
Well, to you, every word should be sacred.
sacred. Well, when you write at 800 pages, I think even the author has to admit not every word is sacred. I am long-winded. I'm determined. I don't want to suggest that the book is dull or not fast-paced. I think it's a real Indiana Jones kind of yarn. But St. Martin's would probably be interested at this point in a slightly shorter book. I've decided my first book was 400 pages. This is 800 pages, and I'm aiming for 600 for the next one. But I don't know. Maybe this will sell very well, and I can indulge myself in 1,200. I can sort of proceed geometrically, 2,400, 4,800, 48,000. Yeah, keep going.
St. Martin's Press was also my publisher, and I published a novel, thriller, in 1988, but it was under 200 pages. took me about 4 years to write it.
I can't clear my throat in under 200 pages. My God, how do you get people in and out of a door 200 pages?
Well, I don't know. It took me a long time to write even that. No, well, that's not true. I've read some gems, books that are very slender. Edna O'Brien, for example, does not write a lot of books, but every word is packed. You can put so much into it that just a couple of sentences will tell you everything. You might even cover a decade and just a few paragraphs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are certainly writers like that. I think my editor told me there are people that are taker-outers and people that are putter-inners. I'm afraid I'm an everything-in-the-kitchen-sink kind of writer. I love the details. I love the rich descriptions of things. When you go to a place in my book, I hope you feel like you can smell it and you know the temperature of the day and you know what the weather's like and you know how the characters are dressed. I want you to be there, and I spare you no detail.
Well, I can tell that you have been to those places. Now, I have visited Oxford, and it was so many years ago that I just vaguely remember the ivy and the buildings and the rather dark, grim buildings, although the whole area was attractive. But you brought it home to me because my mind is just I guess it's old age, I think it is. But I was only there a day or 2 days as a tourist. Obviously, you spent time there.
And, 4 years. Yeah.
So I could see, I mean, I got a good feeling of what Oxford looked like and felt like. Same feeling I had in Ireland. You know, it was, there's a little island that where the protagonist go to try to find the scroll. Is there really an island
yeah,
up there?
Yeah, I didn't make up the island, nor did
is
I make
is there a monastery on the island?
No, like? There the Hare Krishnas are there. It used to be a retreat. It is so windswept. It is so remote. Well, it's not really that remote. I don't think it takes longer than 15 minutes to get over there by a boat, but it is. That's very rough water. I mean, that's the north coast of Ireland. The sea is very rough, and it's a very remote, desolate kind of place. But the island does exist, and I invented the monastery that was there. But that's all I invented. Certainly the weather I didn't invent.
Why, when you started working on gospel, or before you started working on gospel, how was it that you became interested in religion, especially in the historical aspects of it?
I guess I've always had sort of a amateur theologian sort of bent to me. I've always been fascinated by religions. I was an art history minor in college, and I love architecture and the great cathedrals. But if you poke your head in a number of great cathedrals, if you look at a lot of good art, you see things that you can't really explain. I recall being in Italy, in Florence, and looking up at this picture in the Uffizi of this house flying with wings. Angels were bearing this house aloft, and there was the Virgin looking very triumphal, sort of astride her house. It was such an awkward, silly picture. I thought, well, what on earth is it? And, of course, it's the translation of the Holy House of Loreto, which in 1294 flew from Nazareth by way of Yugoslavia, touched down for a year or so, picked up, moved again, and set down in 1294 in Loreto, and it's still there. And the Catholic Church has made this sacred house in which Mary received the Annunciation. This house is the sort of patron object of astronauts and flyers everywhere. And the more I scratch the surface of particularly Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, the Oriental Christian traditions of the Copts and the Armenians, there's hundreds of these kind of stories. And I realized, having a rather generic Christian Southern background, I didn't know any of this stuff. So I guess it started with the art and architecture and your basic tourist taking pictures, and it began to be more and more of an interest to see where all these crazy stories come from. And I don't think people know church history very well. Well, there's 2,000 years of it, so why should they? But there's some really outlandish characters in the church. There are some popes that are as sinful as any human beings have ever been. There are some saints that should have been. It's very funny. You read about some of these saints that flagellate themselves and wish to be stripped and humiliated in public. In our post-Freudian sophistication, we sit there and go, we understand what they were after. But the Middle Ages didn't, and perhaps made these people saints. So I tried, in many ways, the book is sort of an encyclopedia of the strange things that I've run across in 3 or 4 years of solid reading and research. And I've included some Jewish mysticism and Islamic mysticism and stuff, too. So I think I've got all the great religions factored in.
Well, I was startled by the extent of violence in the name of religion in the book. The extent of torture and this sort of thing.
It seems like no sooner did the church establish itself after all the Roman persecutions than they turned around and did it, too. I'm afraid that's intractable part of human nature. I will say that there was always, even in darkest periods, there usually is someone, some still small voice, that says, this is not what the church should be doing. This is not what Jesus would have us do, or what God would have us do, or what Muhammad would have us do. But these people are often ignored, and alas, all religious history is fraught with this kind of persecution and violence.
It's still going on, though, isn't it?
Sure is. Well, wherever there's fanaticism, you get this kind of thing. We've just had someone a doctor killed at an abortion clinic by a fanatic. We see the situation in Waco, which is a fanatic. We've seen Islamic fanatics blow up the basement in the World Trade Center. I don't know, as long as there's religion, that we will ever not have fanatics. I'm not sure that we're ever going to arrive at a lovely ecumenical world in which everyone respects each other's opinions. And nor do I think we're going to arrive at a world without religion. I mean, I think it's a human need, and it may change and it may alter. And God knows the history of Christianity shows that fashions come and go, and doctrines come and go, and just as, say, priestly celibacy. It didn't used to be, now it is. One day it probably won't be again. I mean, everything changes. Human beings more or less suit themselves each generation. But the need for religion never goes away. And I suspect we'll always have it with us, and alas, we'll probably always have fanatics.
But the United States, I think you would probably agree, is better than most countries with regard to keeping religion in line.
Are you sure about that?
Your early chapters are set in Ireland. While you don't go into a lot of detail about the troubles, as you refer to, I mean, they're always on the surface. I don't know that we have this kind of sectarian violence that you would find in India and
no.
in the Middle East.
No, certainly we're not among the most extreme, but we're also not, I mean, France, Italy, I mean, these people do occasionally, you know, step into a church, but it's mostly, I'm afraid, old women in black with the rosary beads. I don't think people take the church terribly seriously in modern Europe. England is the least church-attending country in Europe. The Anglican Church, they say there's now more practicing Muslims than there are practicing Anglicans in England. what you have is, I think there's a very secular world, Western world, and most people in this country, although 90%, you see these polls, 90% of Americans say that they're religious. But I wonder how many of those people, I think it's like the Victorians said they were religious. I mean, in this, just as now, not many people went to church, then or now. And, I think though that we do have reserves of fundamentalism. It is my own opinion, and I probably get in trouble for this, but it's my own opinion that when a religion is in its death throes, when it is ceasing to become, a player in society, fundamentalism always goes on the rise. I don't think Christianity is capable of producing a Sistine Chapel or a Bach Mass or a Chartres Cathedral now. I think its highest, most inspired days are behind it. And I think the rise of Christian fundamentalism, and of course I grew up in the South, so I'm used to these people. But I think this, there doesn't seem to be anything high, there doesn't seem to be anything elevating about fundamentalism. It is an unthinking, sort of blinkered view that it's written here, and therefore it must be true. And it's highly selective what people choose to decide is absolutely inflexible word of God and what they choose to overlook. I hope if any fundamentalist would read my book, I can imagine them burning it. I don't know if they're going to read it, but if they read my book, I would hope that it would give them some pause with the talk about the textual problems of the Bible and the contradictions in the Bible, of which there are many.
Now, you, as the author of Gospel, which is tied up in knots around religion, or vice versa, to what extent are you religious?
Well, I'd like to make a distinction between spiritual and religious. I'm not an atheist. I guess I'm sort of a high agnostic. I feel there's something. I do believe there's God. I believe there's some organizing moral force in the universe. But in a strange way, I gotta make a pretty good Hindu, I think, because I think it's all a little true. I think like the Navajos and their gods and the Shiva in India or Zoroaster in Iran or Allah in the Arab world. I mean, it's all a little true, isn't it? I mean, These religions provide their miracles and their healings and their unexplained events and their prophecies. And I have a feeling it's all just a little bit true. So I guess there's a polytheist in me somewhere.
Well, tell me a little bit about the premise of the book, which deals, of course, with a mystery scroll that everybody's after, a la, as you mentioned, mm-hmm. Indiana Jones.
That's right. It's that's real publishing speak for you. Isn't it? The thinking man's Indiana Jones. But that's what the book is. What we have here is a chase, an intellectual debate, a treatise, a slapstick, a farce that rages across four continents and several countries. Keep in mind, the New Testament, the first four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, there is not a one of these things that we have any earlier copy of than about 425. We have three great codexes. And 400 is about the earliest copies we have of things. Now, we have an Oxyrhynchus John, which is about 125, but it's just a fragment. We have a very early version of Mark, found in 1956 at the Marsaba Monastery, but we're essentially saying the books that you see in your Bible are some 300, 400 years down the road from the times they were written. And you got to ask a question. If a gospel was turned up like the Dead Sea Scrolls in an earthen jug, and it was written, say, 70 A.D. or 60 A.D. from the time of the beginnings of the Christian Church, would it agree with what's in the Bible? My suspicion is it wouldn't.
It would not.
It would not at all. There's been a lot of interpolation. There's been a lot of anti-Semitism woven into Greek anti-Semitism woven into the Gospels. I mean, a real example of that is John. I mean, Pontius Pilate, according to Josephus, was just a murderous, horrible man. There's not one nice thing written about him anywhere. There is anything written about him. But he becomes this sort of almost defense lawyer for Jesus by the Gospel of John. You know, I see no fault in this man. And there's almost a sense that Pilate really wants to save him. Well, this is nonsense. This is, of course, a Greek church writing to show the treachery of the Jews. It's a very anti-Semitic gospel. At that point, the Christian Church was moving from a Jewish sect within the organized Jewish religion to a world faith, mostly due to Paul, who I think invents Christianity. So I let that premise ruminate for a while. I said to myself, what would it be like if one of these gospels turned up? There's a book out now about the Gospel of Q. I call it Q. It's supposed to be the earlier version that Matthew and Mark were copied from. And it does not have a resurrection sequence, and there's an awful lot. Most theologians deal with Q quite seriously, but I'm sure there would be people who, if Q ever turned up, would want to see it burned. There would also be people from museums and universities who want to get their hands on it just for its value. So what we have is a chase. I have a lapsed Jesuit professor who is looking for one last great academic glory. He has a grad student he's saddled with from his department that wants her to ride shotgun, this rather frumpish Irish Catholic's grad student at the University of Chicago. And together they try to beat out the collectors and the greedy people and the fanatics and the monks and everyone else who wants their hand on it. And then it goes from Oxford to Ireland to Italy to Greece to Jerusalem, up the Nile, past Egypt to the Sudan and Ethiopia. We get a whole tour of the incredible diversity that's in the Christian Church. I think we are lazy in this country about thinking, we think people are pretty much like us. We just don't understand why people aren't like us. If they just gave it a shot, they'd be like us. And it's reinforced by the fact that immigrants come over and want to be like us. So we think that people are all pretty much the same, but people are not the same. People are very different. You get to Ethiopia, and that Christianity involves sacrificing animals and pouring blood over people and letting the demons jump from their body into the blood, which runs into a pit. And then you cut the sheep into 12 pieces, and you eat the 12 pieces for the 12 disciples. And this is Christianity, too. There is an incredible range on it. And I wanted to sort of introduce readers that are sort of used to the suburban church like I am, the incredible range of people that call themselves Christians. I could have done the same thing for Jews and Muslims if I'd put my mind to it.
Now, if there is a missing book here from the Bible or a newly discovered one, I just wonder how accurate is the Bible as history, whether or not we have newly discovered documents.
I think the Old Testament's quite accurate.
The Old Testament?
Yeah.
Talking about 7 days and 7 nights and
days. No, there is obviously some
Jonah and the whale?
There's some symbolism to that. I'm saying in terms of the history, like the Kings and Judges and the real historical books of the Bible that give Jewish history and the rise and fall of the first nation of Israel. I think that's actually fairly accurate. Now, of course, it's all interpreted in terms of God's favor and disfavor, but I think the names and the places are probably pretty close. And I'll tell you why I think that. When the Dead Sea Scrolls turned up, there was tremendous outrage and opposition. There were Hasidic rabbis and ultra-conservative rabbis who just would as soon burn the Dead Sea Scrolls, because, as you know, there's countless commentaries of the rabbis, the great edges of the rabbis, just tract after tract, commentary after commentary, about sometimes even sort of the punctuation, about even the order of words. And suddenly here comes this thing that is 900 years earlier than anyone has seen before, and it's bound to upset this thing. Well, the Jews didn't really have much to worry about. The book of Isaiah, they found, was almost to a word exactly what had been copied. I think there's a difference. I think the Jews who were doing the copying through the centuries thought God was watching. They're very careful. I know the Christians haven't been so careful. The Christians have, there are a number of church figures, very shadowy, that I think had a hand in rewriting and doing a real touch-up job on the Gospels. What we have is virtually a committee's decision on what we know about Jesus. Yet for all the inaccuracies and inauthentic passages. I think that there was a historical Jesus, and I think that he was probably a rather revolutionary individual. I don't think he was just another Jewish reformer. There are a lot of things that are fairly foreign to his time, like the pacifism. Turn the other cheek is not standard practice in the ancient world. A lot of people have tried to make an argument the Dead Sea Scrolls show pre-existing cults of rabbis that Jesus could have been, but the Dead Sea Scrolls are very violent. There's lots of swords coming down and avenging of God on these people who've done Israel wrong, and Jesus wasn't like that at all. So I think he must have been a very different kind of leader, a different kind of reformer, and I think what we have is, to use Paul's phrase, I think we look at him through a glass darkly, but we have, I think, the essential things that he stood for and the essential teachings enough that I still think it's worth a great deal to read the New Testament.
It's fascinating, isn't it? The whole idea is fascinating because it blends not only our hopes and fears and frustrations, but what may have happened in terms of history.
I think a lot of the miracles, I think Jesus has value for me, even if those miracles aren't there. A big deal made over the virgin birth. Well, Osiris was born of a virgin. Attis was born of a virgin. Mithra from Persia was born of a virgin. Adonis is born of a virgin. They're all born of a virgin. Every kind of messianic figure is born of a virgin. I mean, it was obviously an attempt to spread the thing, you know, throughout the world, that they sort of tried to say, well, we'll match you miracle for miracle. What possible difference does it make if he was born of a virgin?
That might catch on today.
You could even a lot of fundamentalists are determined that that Christianity has no meaning if there is not a resurrection. Well, again, we could go through the list. Tammuz resurrected, died in 3 days, wound in his side, came back in 3 days. Mithra, son of God, he was the light, he was the son of the sun god. Dies, comes back after 3 days. There is so much pre-existing mythology that has been grafted onto Christianity that a fundamentalist sets himself up for a really rude awakening if he learns his history. And that's, I guess, what I would ask a fundamentalist if they were screaming and yelling at me, which I'm sure as the book tour goes on, I may get that opportunity. I would say, look, it's for your own good that I write this book, that I try to shake your faith. I mean, is that all it's based on? Miracles? Someone told you that someone did a miracle 2,000 years ago, and that's why you believe? I mean, are you that credulous? Isn't there anything in what Jesus teaches? Is there anything in his personality or how he treated his fellow men and women? Does none of this move you? Is it all miracles and walking on water? Is this all you care about? Because I think one of these days a gospel's going to turn up. Q might just pop up one day. Archaeology is a very recent science, Don. I mean, they've only been digging for the last 100 years. They're bound to find something. And will the Christian church survive it? Is there nothing more than the dependence on these miracles, this sort of magic medicine show? Is that all that it is? Or is there something, a philosophy greater than that, that can survive these revelations when they finally come out?
Well, you know your stuff. You really worked at this book. I mean, I couldn't conceivably be able to recite the things that you have. I mean, it's something that is very close to you, and as I said before, the research shows. Where did you go to school, by the way?
I went to Michigan State University. Not exactly a hotbed of theology.
Well, but you were born in North Carolina?
I was born in North Carolina.
How did you go to Michigan?
Well, at the risk of being meretricious for broadcasting, I was going to be a broadcaster. I discovered, as I will discover when I listen to your show, that I sound like Mickey Mouse on the air a few times, so I got discouraged. And then I tried television for a while, and then it occurred to me at some point that when television stations, when CBS wants to hire a writer, they go out and hire writers. They don't go hire telecommunications majors. So I decided to go to what really was my, I think, first calling, which is writing. And I worked on the student paper at Michigan State and moved to New York to make my fortune. This is the quickie life story.
When did you get to New York?
1982.
This is right after college?
I literally got in the car after graduation and drove out. Mm-hmm. $800 in my pocket, that could be done in 1982. Could find a rent for about $225. That could be done too in 1982.
And you did that?
I did that in Brooklyn. I was in Greenpoint, Brooklyn. and which I loved. I still love it. I think it may be, I think it's far more expensive now. It's been discovered, but it certainly wasn't discovered when I was there. No one spoke English in my building. It was lots of Polish illegal aliens, you know, huddled behind the door, wondering if I was an immigration man. I sort of kept my neighbors on the toes that way. That was all right. And everything was cheap. You could get a $1.50 meal. Anyway, I'm sounding like an old timer, but I mean, it's a wonderful place. And I called magazines and I said, "Will you give me a job?" And they said no. And then I said, "Well, who does your temp services?" And I'd sign up with those temp agencies and keep getting sent in as a secretary or a computer programmer or something, anything to get in the door. And eventually I wore enough people down over at Time Warner or Time Inc. or Time Life. God, they've gone through so many incarnations since I was there. That they finally set up this interview for me at People magazine, and I thought I had this job. I thought this was in the can, and they didn't like me. And then bizarrely, I ended up at Sports Illustrated. But I had, coming from North Carolina.
What did you do at Sports Illustrated?
Well, I started out, you know, basically getting coffee for people at first. I you know, did everything that was. I did all kinds of menial things and typed letters. But eventually, I ingratiated myself and I started submitting things on motorsports. I really enjoyed my time at Sports Illustrated. I don't have a complaint. Although the magazine simply does not do enough on stock car racing, which of course is God's sport. It's the greatest sport. And I, from North Carolina, felt that, that ought to be represented more. So I wrote stories. They liked them and they put them in the trash can. And, that's pretty much still how it works. I submit maybe one or two things a year to them.
Now, how did your first novel come about?
Well, I knew I wanted to write it. I wanted to write it, but the thing about writing a novel, writing creatively, is after you've finished making stock car drivers eloquent, after you've put all your genius into taking, well, we went out, we won the race, and we tried real hard, and well, I just kept my foot down. After you've turned that into great prose, there's really not a lot left. And I would get home, and I just didn't want to see a typewriter. And it's a weekly magazine. There's no leisure on a weekly magazine. There's always some horrible ordeal each and every week that hanging over you. I realized I could never possibly write a novel and work there at the same time. But who was going to walk away from Sports Illustrated? But Time Life was very progressive, and they said, "Well, you can go to grad school." So I decided to go to grad school with absolutely no interest in the degree. I was going to write the novel in my spare time, and I didn't want to take the GREs. So a friend rather lightly suggested, "Oh, go to Oxford or Cambridge." And frankly, with Michigan State in my background, I didn't think they would be interested. But I made a very, very secret application. And I sent a few of my sports articles with it too. Told them that I wanted to investigate British sports and learn about British beers. I mean, I wrote a very sort of lighthearted kind of letter. Well, they loved it. They took me. And for the next 4 years, I got a master's, and I taught American literature at Oxford.
You got a master's in literature at Oxford?
Yeah.
In American literature?
In, modern literature.
I was going to say they wouldn't.
Modern for them stops at about World War I, of course. You know, Henry James is considered modern, and that's what I did my thesis on.
So you were there for 4 years, huh?
I was there for 4 years. Two of them were the master's. The other two I taught and pretended to work on a doctorate, which one day I hope I'll finish. I did write the book in my spare time, and it got published, thank God. And that was my first book, Emma Who Saved My Life, which is a crazy bohemian New York novel set in the 70s in the theater world. And that was 89. And then that made enough money that I could write the second one. And in fact, I spent every cent that I made on Emma Who Saved My Life traveling. I took about an 8-month trip, more or less doing what my characters did.
When you traveled, obviously, you must have taken notes.
Nope, never. I never take a note. I didn't have an outline. I didn't have a note card for this book. My sense is
photographs.
I'm a manic photographer.
Sometimes I notice that if I go someplace, I can take photographs, and even though I might not take notes, I can look at the photograph, and
everything comes back,
and you can put it down in ways that sometimes are even better than making notes.
Oh, I think that's right too. I took lots of pictures. I also, I'm also convinced that you don't really, really have to travel somewhere to write about it. I mean, it helps, but I mean, that is what you're supposed to do for a living. At least what I'm supposed to do for a living. I'm supposed to make things up.
Well, I was talking to a young author by the name of Paul Watkins,
mm-hmm.
who travels also in the way that Graham Greene traveled.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
His new novel is set in Ireland. But he told me, it was a very telling statement that I think you probably might agree with. He said, "I travel I don't really have to go there, but it confirms what I already know.
That's right. That's absolutely right. I wish I thought to say it first. It's true. I think you're going to sort of check out that what you were going to do is going to be all right to do anyway. There are some things. There are some details, and I've been told this by people who've never been to these places. They feel like they've been. I mean, there are certain things that I noticed when I was in Jerusalem. Certain things that you notice about Ireland that you wouldn't know them if you didn't see them. And there is nothing to replace that. That's really good. But I do believe that a very careful writer can fake almost anything. And I know that's the great dictum of writing classes. Write about what you know, but that makes for a lot of self-centered, rather uneventful fiction. I'd much rather write about what I don't know, what I'd like to find out about.
Stanley Elkin, you probably know his work. He teaches at Washington University in St. Louis. He advises his students, write about what you don't know, because he's talking to 18, 20, 22-year-old kids. He says they don't know anything.
Yeah, right. I certainly didn't know anything at 19. I tried to write a little novel when I was 19. It was sort of a potboiler, Faulkner, everybody either killing or sleeping with everybody else in the family. It was a real little turgid thing. It was odd as a result of absolutely knowing nothing about life. And don't worry, it's burned. This bit of juvenilia will not surface after my untimely death.
Paul Watkins, the young man I just referred, he's only 28. All of his books, except for one, they're historical novels. World War, the Irish Rebellion, 1922. Flight across the Atlantic to beat Lindbergh, 1929. Or was it 28? I can't remember.
28.
World War II.
It's a Red Badge of Courage, greatest war novel in our tradition. Stephen Crane never saw anything of the front. I mean, I'm probably going to get called on this, but it seems to me Melville was only at sea for something like 9 months. I mean, you'd think that he lived for years that way. So, no, I think there you could go through. There's lots and lots of great writers and observant writers who make things up. Obviously, Dickens wasn't at the French Revolution it was the best of times, it was the worst of times. I mean, there's a lot to be said for making things up. That's what we're supposed to do anyway.
Well, I think it gives you some insulation, too, because after I had written this book about Mencken or St. Martin's Press, I published a semi-autobiographical novel about a young broadcaster in the 1960s, and I was never able to place that book. And then rereading it a year or so ago, I saw how terribly self-indulgent it was and not very interesting. I mean, I'm not sure that anybody would really care. It was heavily disguised, but, I mean, there were a lot of autobiographical elements. But my life isn't particularly interesting or dramatic enough that I think people would want to read about it, you know?
Oh, whose is? Whereas, short of Lindbergh, I mean.
Yeah, whereas the Mencken book, I didn't even have an agent. I just gave it to St. Martin's and they bought it. And so I think that's the kind of book my next book should be. In fact, it will be. It's about Ambrose Bierce.
Oh, wow. Put me on the list for that one. I'm a great fan of Bierce.
It'll take me years to finish it. I've been working on it for 3 or 4 years now.
Well, he needs to be reintroduced to people.
I agree. If I'm able to finish this book and do it successfully, he will be.
It's interesting you mention him. I believe that the great ignored tradition, and it's being, I mean, there's a few people out there. I think Tom Wolfe and Bonfire of the Vanities is doing it. But that one of our best traditions, one of our richest veins, is that kind of dark, bleak, you know, grim humor turned in an acid way upon ourselves. I mean, Mencken, Bierce, Twain, Sinclair Lewis. I mean, these men never said die. I mean, they may have ended up drunk and bitter and alone, but they never said die. They always went with the long knives, you know, after American society. Dos Passos. I'm a great fan of John Dos Passos. I mean, the USA Trilogy is one of the nastiest books ever written about America. And he apparently ended his life quite conservative, you know, quite a Republican. But nonetheless, in fact, I think all of these men were somewhat conservative. I don't think you see much of that great nasty tradition on the left. But I want my next book. I would like for the reader to put down and go, that is possibly the most unkind, uncharitable, nasty book ever written about contemporary America. I mean, I want to leave the rest of these guys behind in the dust. And these men are my icons, you know, Sinclair Lewis and particularly Mencken. I mean, he must have been horrible to know personally. I don't know, but I mean, his writing is wonderful.
How did you get to New Orleans?
Well, I was leaving Europe and I wanted to be somewhere semi European, and I've been there a few times. As it turns out, New Orleans is neither European nor American. It's something entirely itself. It's but there is a there are a number of old world survivals there that made me quite happy. I like to. I'm afraid I'm spoiled now. I like to live where there's some history. I have to live where there's good food. After 4 years of England, I was in desperate need of good food, and I put on weight just incredibly there, which I'm at the moment trying to take off. But I thought
I'm not sure New Orleans is the place to do it.
No, that's not the place to do it. No one, but you know, it doesn't matter down there. I mean, no one cares. I mean, it's everyone's a little heavy, and there's a lot of smoking and a lot of drinking and a lot of fun. And I always miss it when I'm away from it. I for that matter,
are you gonna stay there?
I'd like to buy some property there.
Really?
Yeah.
New Orleans is not one of my favorite towns. Mm. The weather is not very good. It's so hot and so humid. And,
well, now, where were you brought up?
Houston.
Houston. Well, you see, I was brought up in hot, heat and humidity, too, and you either embrace it as some kind of Proustian sensual memory, or you say, never again, and you walk out. Perhaps you're one of the never again.
Well, I remember flying down to Houston and stopping off in New Orleans on the way, and it was so swelteringly hot, I almost didn't make it. And Houston is bad enough. But
yeah, I think Houston's worse, because we get the Gulf breeze. I don't think you even get a breeze over there. In Houston.
Well, it is 50 miles from the Gulf. That's true. But believe me, it was much more comfortable in Houston. Maybe it was just that particular week. I don't know.
It is hot. It is miserable. I would.
I don't think I
could
stay in Houston
this.
Either. I mean, yeah. I go back and visit my family.
This is the age of air conditioning. I'm not talking about you know living in a shack here. I mean, I'm looking at air condition. And
but you have you essentially being a writer, this is all you do, right? A full-time writer?
Yeah, so far I have been extremely fortunate.
Well,
so
you
young and so
just about
soon.
Any place
to,
you want.
Yeah, and that's where I want. You know, the great thing about New Orleans is people visit you there. If you do move around like I do, you end up having friends all over the place and not exactly where you are. And I New Orleans is a big draw. I get my friends from England to come out and from France or Italy or anywhere in the States. People always want to come and have fun in New Orleans. So it's a great place to – it's a magnet, you know. So people have to see me whether they like me or not.
Have you started your new book yet?
I got to admit I've got a – I'm sort of on hold about two things. There's going to be a Washington chapter, and – I'm waiting before I got to get a reading on the Clinton administration. I mean, is my savagery going to include him, or am I going to end up leading a cheer? I have a feeling
give
I'm
the
not
guy a couple of months yet.
I have a feeling I'm not going to be disappointed. He's got a cabinet full. I mean, I preferred him to anyone that was running too. But I mean, he's got a cabinet full of hacks, and already some of the really tough budget decisions, I think, have been avoided, the agricultural subsidies and things like that. So I think it's going to be business as usual. In fact, I feel it could be a horrible thing. The poor man might find himself at the end of 4 years with things no better and be thrown out, and then we have some horrible right-wing Republican with the religious fundamentalist who will issue a fatwa like Khomeini against me for my book Gospel.
Well, Gospel, it's certainly an achievement. By the way, do you not pronounce the T on your name?
Barnhart. No, I'm just lazy.
I'm
just
lazy.
You
do pronounce the T. Right. Because I've heard it both ways, Barnhard or Barnhart. So it could be either way. But
I think I'm related to all the other Barnharts. It's B-A-R-N, but I believe that was simply a Southern variation. I think most of the family far back enough is B-E-R-N. And
well, Gospel is certainly an achievement, and congratulations to you, and I wish you well on your next book.
Thanks so much.
I can hardly wait. Thanks a lot.